From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, predicting the behavior of a waking volcano, a talk with volcanologist Dan Miller. He and his team of geologists warned officials of the eruption of Mount St. Helens, which blew 20 years ago. We'll talk with them about their work then and ask him about the volcanoes they're watching now. Miller and his colleagues are profiled in the new book, Volcano Cowboys. Also, an onstage conversation between film critic Roger Ebert and actor Willem Dafoe, recorded at the Cannes Film Festival. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Malinka's Dance, the new recording by Marty Ehrlich's quartet, Traveler's Tales. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Bridgestone Firestone Tire Company says it will recall millions of tires that have been linked to fatal accidents. The company will voluntarily take back 6.5 million tires, most of which were made for light trucks and sport utility vehicles. Bridgestone says it will notify customers and replace the tires in three phases, beginning in Arizona, California, and Texas. Federal highway safety officials are investigating hundreds of complaints about the tires, including reports of 46 deaths. The tire treads reportedly peel off, sometimes at high speeds. The Republican vice presidential nominee visited an inner-city homeless shelter in St. Louis today. Dick Cheney came to push the GOP plan for federal financial support for faith-based organizations. Kevin Lavery reports from member station KWMU.
Fresh off a whistle-stop tour of several Midwestern states, Cheney outlined a plan to lend government aid to faith-based organizations. He said a Bush-Cheney administration would expand the federal charitable income tax deduction, build on the charitable choice plan, and offer federal support for after-school programs.
Today, federal after-school programs tend to discourage the participation of faith-based groups and other community organizations. This will change if we're given the opportunity to change it. We want to encourage faith-based programs to compete for those federal resources.
Cheney also praised Vice President Al Gore's selection of Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman as his running mate and added that no supporter of the Bush-Cheney ticket should have any cause to take issue with Lieberman's religious background. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Lavery in St. Louis.
Two men are being questioned in connection with yesterday's bomb blast in central Moscow. At least 7 people were killed and more than 90 injured when the explosion ripped through an underground walkway. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Repair workers and electricians were still at work even as the burnt-out underground walkway in Pushkin Square was reopened. Shocked Russians left flowers at the site of the blast, a passageway filled with shops that leads to 3 metro stations. It's in the heart of Moscow and is often crowded, as it was during rush hour yesterday when the explosion occurred. President Vladimir Putin promised a tough response, saying that's the only medicine to cure terrorism, but he urged Russians not to jump to conclusions. Authorities were quick to blame Chechens, just as they did 1 year ago in the wake of deadly apartment bombings. Chechnya's president has denied his forces were involved. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 71 points to close at 10,905 in active trading of 1 billion shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 5 points to close at 3,853. This is NPR News. The national president of the NAACP has suspended the president of the group's Dallas branch for making anti-Semitic remarks about Senator Joseph Lieberman, Al Gore's running mate. National President Kwaisi Mfume suspended Lee Alcorn, calling his remarks repulsive, anti-Semitic, and anti-American. Alcorn made his remarks during a radio interview in Dallas. He later said his comments were taken out of context and that he is not anti-Semitic but anti-Lieberman. 2 small planes collided over southern New Jersey today, killing all 11 people aboard. Doug Doyle reports from member station WBGO in Newark.
Federal investigators are not sure what caused the planes to collide shortly before 8 o'clock this morning. All the victims were from Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Authorities say no one on the ground was hurt, despite wreckage falling onto a house, setting the building on fire. The couple inside fled unharmed. Neighbors at a nearby condominium screamed after seeing the sight. The 11th body was located late this afternoon inside the wreckage of one of the planes after search teams had spent the afternoon combing a 30-acre field. Authorities say seven passengers, all civilian naval employees, and two crew members were on a chartered Piper Navajo from the Lakehurst Naval Air Engineering Station. Two people died on the second plane, a Piper Seminole from Northeast Philadelphia Airport. For NPR News, I'm Doug Doyle in Newark.
The Reform Party convention in Long Beach, California, erupted in shouting matches for a second day as two factions fight over more than $12 million in federal campaign funding. The struggle's taking place between supporters of Texas billionaire Ross Perot and backers of former Republican Pat Buchanan. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. In the past 20 years, the field of volcano science has progressed at warp speed, in part because of one catastrophic event, the eruption of Mount St. Helens in May of 1980. Starting in the mid-70s, my guest, volcanologist Dan Miller, was part of a team of scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey studying Mount St. Helens. The geological data told them that Mount St. Helens had erupted every 100 years for the last four millennia, a pattern which meant that by the late 1970s, the volcano was overdue. The team also predicted that the eruption had the potential to be catastrophic. Magma or molten rock beneath the surface of the mountain was building up. They warned that Mount St. Helens could spew tons of deadly ash and also produce mud flows, which could bury hundreds of miles of roads, homes, and wildlife on the mountain. The question was when. Dan Miller is a resident geologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. He heads their Volcano Disaster Assistance Program and was one of the members of the survey's response team at Mount St. Helens when it went. He and his colleagues are profiled in a new book, Volcano Cowboys, by journalist Dick Thompson. I asked Dan Miller what was happening on the mountain in the weeks before it blew.
Well, we knew something serious was coming because there were literally thousands of earthquakes per day occurring at Mount St. Helens, and they started on March 20th, and they marched on a steady series of very large events. I mean, every day there were as many as 8 or 10 magnitude 4 earthquakes, and there were literally hundreds of earthquakes that were smaller than that. So we knew something serious was happening. We knew that magma was moving up into the volcano. We could detect that by the changes in the shape of the volcano. There was a very prominent bulge that developed on the north side of the volcano and began moving steadily forward at 4 or 5 feet per day. So we knew the volcano was becoming progressively more unstable. By the time early May rolled around, we fully expected some kind of a major collapse of the north flank of the volcano. And we expected that that would be followed by an explosive eruption. Mainly, we envisioned a vertical eruption. And so we were a little bit surprised or taken aback by the magnitude of the lateral explosion that occurred on the morning of May 18.
Where were you when Mount St. Helens went? And what did you see?
Well, I was driving up Interstate 5. I was about 5 miles north of Vancouver, up on a flat part of the road where I had a good view of Mount St. Helens. And I was actually headed up to the north side to our Coldwater 2 observation post. And I had fresh batteries for some time-lapse cameras up there and a few parts to fix one of our cameras. And I had intended to spend the day up there working on those cameras and observing the volcano. At 8:32, as I was driving up I-5, I looked off to the northeast, and there was this gigantic mushroom cloud rising above the mountain. And as I watched, it accelerated and climbed to maybe 40 or 50,000 feet and was still climbing. And at that point, I recognized that this was a much larger eruption than any of the small steam eruptions that we had seen prior to this morning, and that it was a major magmatic eruption. And so I turned around quickly and got onto the southbound part of the freeway and raced back to Vancouver. I ran up into the office that we shared with the U.S. Forest Service there, and that was sort of the beginning of the busiest day of my life.
You had a colleague posted at one of your observation posts. Did you know immediately from what you had seen that he might be in danger?
Immediately, I didn't know. You're referring to my good friend and colleague, David Johnston, and he was at Coldwater 2 at the observation post that I was headed for that morning. And when I saw the big eruption, I thought, wow, you know, that's neat. He's going to have a good view of it, and he's up there and can take notes and see what's happening. When I rushed back into the office in Vancouver, the first thing that I did was ran over to our radio transmitter, and I radioed Dave to see what was happening. And I didn't receive an answer from Dave, and not only that, I didn't even receive an answer from the repeater that we had located on a mountaintop that was quite a ways further away from the volcano than Dave Johnston was. And at that point, I had a sickening feeling, a realization that the eruption was a huge eruption and that something really devastating had happened that had destroyed our radio repeater at a distance of about, I guess it was about 8 miles due north of the volcano. And I had a bad feeling that something terrible had probably happened to Dave at that point.
Dave Johnston did die in the eruption. What happened to him?
Well, he was located on a ridgetop about 5 miles due north of Mount St. Helens. When the eruption began, the north flank of the volcano broke loose. It had become very unstable due to the bulging that occurred toward the north. As it broke loose, the whole north flank slid down into the valley of the North Fork of the Toutle River. And it essentially depressurized. It was sort of like popping the cork on a bottle of champagne. Inside the volcano was a pressurized body of magma or partially molten rock. And when the landslide depressurized it, it blew up. And it blew up very violently. It produced this cloud, a very turbulent cloud of rocks and ash and hot gases that expanded very rapidly to the north. By the time it reached the ridge that Dave was on, it was moving at several hundred miles an hour, and there were hot rocks as large as 3 or 4 feet across that were flying through the air at 300 or 400 miles an hour. So Dave and the car that he had and the trailer house that we had parked up there were hit by this cloud, this blast cloud, which, by the way, continued to accelerate. It reached speeds of perhaps 700 miles an hour. It spread out to completely destroy an area of 230 square miles in the course of about 3 or 4 minutes from the onset of the eruption. So Dave was presumably killed by this expanding blast cloud.
Who were the people besides your colleague and some other scientists? Who were the people who died in the blast? Were there tourists still on the mountain?
Yes, there were many people, campers, hikers, and people interested in seeing the volcano and in filming it and photographing it and watching what was happening. There were hazard zones, closed zones, a so-called blue zone and a red zone that were established around the mountain to keep people out except for scientists and law enforcement people. Those zones didn't always coincide with the hazard zones that we as scientists felt were hazardous places to be. And there were loggers from logging companies working in and around the blast zone. And so we were very fortunate, actually, that the eruption occurred on a Sunday morning, because there would have been as many as 200 or 300 additional people killed if it had been on a weekday when the loggers would have been up there working. But I guess Dave Johnston was the only scientist that I'm aware of who was killed. And there was a photographer working for a local newspaper and for National Geographic by the name of Reed Blackburn. And he was at one of our observation posts, and he was killed. And to the best of my knowledge, the rest of the people who were killed were tourists or loggers or sightseers who were up there, many of them looking at the volcano.
You and your other colleagues later, when it was safe, flew over the part of the mountain that was devastated in the eruption. What did it look like, and what did it smell like?
Well, it was the strangest thing that I've ever seen in my life, because I had worked at Mount St. Helens beginning in 1974, and I had been there for 2 months before May 18, and I had worked out there nearly every day. So I knew the north side of the volcano like the back of my hand, and I knew what Spirit Lake looked like. I knew what the forested hills and ridges to the north of the volcano looked like. I knew what our observation post looked like because I had spent a lot of my time up there. On the morning after the eruption, when we flew in by helicopter to try to find Dave and find out what had happened to Dave, it was a brand new, really bizarre landscape that greeted us. I mean, the first time we landed on these hot new deposits, it was like landing on the moon. Here we were standing in an area 230 square miles in area without a living thing. There were no trees left. There were no animals left. There were no insects. There were no birds. There was no noise. The ground was hot. There was steam coming out of the ground from thousands and thousands of places. You had to watch where you walked to keep from sinking into these deposits that would have literally started your clothes on fire. So it was a very strange situation. I mean, in the twinkling of an eye, this incredible forested landscape with beautiful virgin trees that were 200 feet high were transformed into a dead wasteland, essentially, that literally did look like the moon. It was a gray color. There was no other color but gray. So my colleagues and I walked around in this environment and looked at what had happened, and I mean, it was hard to know where to begin. This was a totally new landscape.
My guest is volcanologist Dan Miller. He's a resident geologist for the United States Geological Survey, and he heads the survey's Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, which helps developing countries in the event of a volcanic eruption. Miller has studied volcanoes all over the world, and he was part of the USG Surveys team during the Mount St. Helens eruption. Dan, we're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is volcanologist Dan Miller. He heads the U.S. Geological Survey's Volcano Disaster Assistance Program and was part of the survey's team at Mount St. Helens when it erupted. After Mount St. Helens blew, new research into another West Coast volcano indicated that it too was showing signs of activity. The volcano was a tourist destination in the town of Mammoth Lakes in California. The survey issued a warning, which was met with hostility from the community.
At Mount St. Helens, as we've been talking, there were some very clear symptoms that the volcano was waking up before May 18. And these included swarms of earthquakes, deformation of the ground, and volcanic gases that were coming out of the ground. Well, in the early 1980s, we began to see the same kinds of things happening in the Mammoth Lakes area of central eastern California. And it really scared us because this is an area that has produced many volcanic eruptions in the past, including explosive ones on various scales, both very, very large and small to moderate. This was an area that seemed to be waking up just the way Mount St. Helens did. And so we very quickly completed a preliminary hazard assessment and published it because we wanted to get that information into the hands of public officials and into the hands of the public, which, by the way, in the region of Mammoth Lakes, there can be 30 or 40,000 people there on a ski weekend or on a busy summer weekend. Unfortunately, this notice of potential hazard that we issued caused all kinds of problems in the town of Mammoth Lakes and for the region in terms of panicking some of the real estate people, their property values may have decreased some, and people were very angry. Instead of appreciating the fact that the U.S. Geological Survey was monitoring their volcanoes and assessing hazards for them and trying to warn them about the possibility of an eruption, many people reacted very negatively, and they were very mistrustful of us and our motives. And for a while, for a number of years there, I was sort of the point person for our agency, and it was my job to try to explain to the populace and to the public officials what the hazards were, why we were concerned about the possibility of eruption, and what the impacts might be. And yes, there were some negative reactions towards my information.
Did someone threaten your life?
Yeah. Somebody did come up to me one time in a restaurant, and a realtor, I guess, and told me that I should watch what I was talking about, and I should stop talking nonsense about hazards, volcanic hazards for Mammoth Lakes, and that if I didn't do so, somebody might put a bomb in my car, which I took as a serious threat, and it was actually pretty scary.
What are the North American hotspots now?
Well, Mammoth Lakes, California continues to be the most active place in the western United States in terms of the kinds of precursors that precede eruptions. There are about 10,000 earthquakes per year that are occurring in the Mammoth Lakes, California area. Many of these earthquakes occur inside a feature that's called a volcanic caldera. It's basically a gigantic volcano crater that the town of Mammoth Lakes is sitting inside of. And there also is evidence of continued bulging or deformation in the middle of the caldera. And there are areas now in the western part of the Long Valley caldera where forests have been killed by volcanic gases that have been coming out of the ground. So I think it's fair to say that there still is unrest occurring. It's been going on now for 20 years in the Mammoth Lakes area. And during that time, we've had two episodes when we think that magma actually moved upwards toward the surface, but fortunately it did not make it to the surface. So I think the most, one of the potential areas for volcanic activity is in the Long Valley Mono Craters area of eastern California. Following that area, that Mount St. Helens is probably the most likely volcano to reawaken in the near future, because it's only been 14 years since the last magmatic eruption at Mount St. Helens, and it could awaken at any point and erupt again.
What about Mount Rainier?
Well, actually, Mount Rainier and the rest of the Cascade Range volcanoes are also candidates for eruptions. Mount Rainier has erupted not as frequently as Mount St. Helens, but still every few hundred years for the last several thousand years. It certainly will erupt again. It's a massive volcano with lots of snow and ice on it. And so any eruption worthy of the name is going to produce hot materials on the summit area that will cause melting of snow and ice, and that will cause huge lahars or mud flows to go down the flanks. So Mount Rainier is, to many of us, it's probably the most hazardous volcano in the United States because it has a great number of people at risk.
Are you confident now that you'll be able to get people out of a danger area before an eruption? Can you and your colleagues call it that closely and that precisely?
Well, no, I can't honestly say that I'm confident. First of all, scientists have nothing to do with making evacuation decisions. And so even if we think a volcano is about to blow up and if we can provide an accurate warning or forecast, we're not involved in forcing people to leave. And so that's a decision that has to be made by somebody else, by public officials, by land use managers, and so forth. However, despite the fact that we've come an incredibly long ways in the last 20 years in terms of our ability to monitor volcanoes and to forecast their eruptions, there still are some issues that remain unresolved. And one of them is that volcanoes, when they start to erupt, they often erupt for months or even years. So we're not looking for one eruption that we try to forecast or one evacuation that public officials have to make. Sometimes there may be 10 or 15 or 20 major eruptions in an eruptive episode, and these might be dragged out over a period of several years. And we have trouble forecasting each of these eruptive episodes in terms of when they occur exactly and how large they will be. And the result is that there are still many uncertainties, and there's a lot that we need to do to continue to improve our ability to forecast individual explosive events in a socially useful context so that people can be evacuated for the event and then come back in after the event.
I would think there's a kind of difficult dichotomy involved in your job, and that the most exciting opportunity for a volcanologist is for a volcano to erupt and for you to be there and to see it and experience it. On the other hand, a lot of your job is working to mitigate the violence and the loss of life from the eruption. You're acutely aware of how dangerous it is and of the danger caused by an eruption. It must be hard to kind of temper your enthusiasm.
Well, you've sort of hit the nail on the head, Barbara. I have to confess that to a volcanologist, when we get to visit an erupting volcano and watch this incredible process take place, that it can be incredibly thrilling. It's exciting. The Earth is alive and kicking, and an erupting volcano is one of the most spectacular events on Earth, I think. And so on the one hand, we tend to be very excited, we're very enthusiastic, we're scientifically very interested, because each time we get to respond to a volcano crisis, we get to add some additional data to our database about how volcanoes work and what kinds of precursors precede eruptions and how to mitigate volcanic hazards. So it is an exciting event for us. However, the downside is a terrible one, and that is that it is really tragic to see a volcano erupt, to see people evacuated from their homes, from their villages, from their livelihoods, from their animals, and their gardens and so forth, and to see what that does to segments of society that are impacted by explosive volcanism. So there's no getting around it that unless a volcano is in a very remote place where it endangers no one, that's a perfect situation for scientists to study a volcano and to learn from it without having this downside. But in many places in the world now, volcanoes are densely populated. And so when they wake up, there are very serious impacts. And even if people are not killed, if they're evacuated in time, the evacuations themselves and what happens to people who are kept out of their homes for months or even years is a disaster of major proportions. So you're right, this is a complicated thing for a volcanologist to see and to be involved in, and it has its downside as well as its scientifically interesting side.
Dan Miller, well, thank you very much for talking with me today.
It's my pleasure.
Dan Miller heads the U.S. Geological Survey's Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, which monitors volcano activity in the U.S. and around the world. He's profiled in the new book Volcano Cowboys by journalist Dick Thompson. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from museumshop.com, an online boutique of products from museums around the world, including the Louvre in Paris and the British Museum in London. Museumshop.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a review of the new recording by Marty Ehrlich's quartet, Traveler's Tales. We're listening to it now. And a conversation from Cannes. We hear an onstage interview between film critic Roger Ebert and Willem Dafoe, recorded at the Cannes Film Festival. Dafoe stars in the upcoming film, Shadow of the Vampire. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Shadow of the Vampire, starring Willem Dafoe and John Malkovich, is a film inspired by the making of the 1922 German film Nosferatu. It's scheduled to be released in December, but audiences got a preview last spring at the Cannes Film Festival. This was also the occasion for an onstage conversation between Dafoe and film critic Roger Ebert, as part of the American Pavilion's Industry in Focus series. We have an excerpt of their conversation to share with you today. Dafoe has appeared in such films as Platoon, Streets of Fire, To Live and Die in L.A., The Last Temptation of Christ, The English Patient, and American Psycho. Roger Ebert is the film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times and hosts Ebert and Roper at the Movies. Nosferatu, F.W. Murnau's black-and-white silent film, was the original Dracula classic. It starred the German actor Max Schreck in a ghoulish, highly stylized portrayal of the vampire. In the upcoming film, Shadow of the Vampire, Willem Dafoe plays Max Schreck. Here's Roger Ebert.
Everybody at this festival is talking about your work as Max Schreck, the Nosferatu. And it's just an amazing performance. And it's certainly on my list of the top two or three performances. I want to start maybe with the exterior and then kind of work into the interior. You disappear. You're not there on the screen. It's not makeup either. I'm not aware of makeup. I'm not aware of whatever you're doing, which is good because I don't want to be. I'm very familiar with the Murnau film, and I simply see someone who could have been in the Murnau film without a single atom being different.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about your technical or physical preparation?
Well, it's such a literal mask. It's such a strong mask. Even in a conventional movie, sometimes I seek out a mask because it frees me up. Mm-hmm. It lets go of my ego agenda. It makes me feel like someone else. It invites different impulses mm-hmm. than I have normally and kind of puts you in a place where you can pretend better. This was so extreme, and I had such a great model with the Max Schreck mm-hmm. role. It started with mimicry, really. And I couldn't really do any work until I couldn't begin my work, except for maybe some superficial reading on Murnau and the period, and of course seeing Murnau's films. The work really started once I got in the makeup, in the costume, because it was so restricting. As you say, I looked in the mirror and I wasn't there anymore. So who was? Max Schreck. It's like a fast track to pretending. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel myself so much anymore. It's a wonderful help. It's a good setup.
And who was Max Schreck, in your opinion? Because he will be forever known, despite the fact that he led a full life, as the Nosferatu. Image will always be remembered exactly as it was in that film.
A perfect case of his success really destroying him, because apparently he didn't work much after that because he couldn't be disassociated from that role. I didn't feel the need so much to know who Max Schreck was. I was more concerned with using his performance in the Nosferatu as a model. And then the other parts of our film that are invention just really came out of the situation and trying to inhabit that mask. It's funny. I mean, I saw the film last night with an audience, and I had seen it once before. And when I watched, I was asking myself some of these questions, and I can't remember, quite frankly. It's a very strong script, and you play the scenes just like you'd play any of those scenes. I don't remember. I see all this eye rolling and all this kind of extreme gestural language. I honestly can't say I analyzed that or intended that. It was just a natural kind of a natural outgrowth of playing the scenes, mm-hmm. as you would almost conventionally. But you've got this wonderful filter that you're playing it through, mm-hmm. and that allows you, you're forced into a different language, to find in a different language, and part of that language is eye rolling and clicking your fingernails. Those aren't ideas, they come out of necessity. The first time you're at lunch and you reach for the salt and your nails go like that, then you go like this, you hear the click, and then you simply find it useful in a scene to express yourself. So,
you have really developed a filmography of worked with some of the best directors that we have, from Scorsese to Oliver Stone, to Alan Parker, to Paul Schrader. These are the best, the most interesting directors in America, and there could be others, of course. What is your relationship as an actor to strong directors like this, auteurs, if we can use that word here at Cannes?
Picking projects, it has so much to do with the director. I feel comfortable with directors that write their own material or are very strong personalities. I think that's partly because, as an actor, I feel most comfortable if I'm serving someone's agenda. If they're passionate, I attach myself to their passion. Mm-hmm. Now, if you attach yourself to someone else, and you're like their agent, you're their doer, you're the person that does what they can't do because they're behind the camera, it really frees you up.
There's also a certain amount of modesty to that approach.
Just like all actors, I've got that, look at me, look at me, look at me, don't look at me. Now, some actors don't have that, don't look at me. But I have it deeply, I do. So in order to say, look at me, look at me, look at me, for that not to be a humiliation and feel like just a egotistic exercise, I get to say, don't look at me because I want to be here. Look at me because we're talking about something else. You know what I mean? It's freeing. It may be a trick. It may be totally a device, but that doesn't matter. I just feel like, you know, you get much closer to things being practical. You stay away from a certain kind of pretentiousness and a certain kind of narcissism. And allows you to transform yourself.
Yeah. You know, what you just said helps me to understand why I admired The Last Temptation of Christ so much. Here is a role. I mean, if there was ever a look at me role, it's Jesus Christ. And if there is ever a role that gives an actor more license than perhaps the actor needs, it's playing Jesus. And that particular film was a deeply spiritual film, but it wasn't a religious film. It wasn't a biblical film. It struck me as being extremely oriented in the man and his experiences without the myth of Jesus, the image of Jesus, or the ego of Jesus, who, after all, can be excused for having a large ego. What you've just said about acting helps to explain, first of all, we know Scorsese is obsessed with the Catholic view anyway, but it explains why you were so grounded there. You were never, most people who play Jesus just take off and never land until the final credits.
I think that's a good observation. I really do. And that's why that movie was very important to me, because that, you know, when I'm saying this stuff, I'm always talking about degrees. Your job is different every time. You're always reinventing your process. But that's a perfect example of that giving over. Some people mistake it for passivity or lack of passion. It's just the opposite. But that was a very reactive role, and I could only give myself over to it if I didn't have a certain kind of agenda or expectation. And because of how the role was built, I think it worked well. It worked well.
On the other hand, in Platoon, which was your first, you'd been acting for 6 years, I believe, at that time, but it was the film that everybody walking out of that film knew who you were. In that one, you were really in it up to your armpits. And yet, at the same time, very much in terms of the daily experience of being a combat infantryman in Vietnam, I never got the feeling that you were the hero of a war movie.
Right.
Or a protagonist of a war movie.
Right. Well, I think the strength of that was, even though it's basically melodrama, it was so rooted in the details of the doing. Mm-hmm. The tasks for an actor in that movie were very concrete. Mm-hmm. That's a different kind of mask. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't deal with egotism there either, because you're doing very specific things. And that gets you away from yourself. And when you get away from yourself, I think it allows you to empathize with someone that isn't you and makes you able to take greater leaps as far as choices and how you play scenes. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you approach a scene and you know too well what has to be accomplished mm-hmm. sometimes. I mean, I'm making a case for a little beginner's mind, you know, here.
When I saw that picture, that's it.
Little can of aggression.
They go to a frenzy. There are behind that wall are all kinds of people who want to be directors and are currently making sandwiches as fast as they can, which I think is excellent training for any director. When I think about Platoon, you know, most movies about war carry with them baggage of millions of war movies, and I think centrally the image of John Wayne or Robert Mitchum or somebody like that, one of the heroes of the 40s. Platoon was about highly skilled technicians going to work every day and doing a really rotten and difficult job. And I found that your performance and the movie in general was not a war movie in the genre sense.
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
a very particular story about a work experience.
Wow.
You know, rarely, there aren't often movies about people who have a job. They had a job.
That's interesting. You know, much is made of our training to make that movie, but it was essential. And what rooted that movie constantly was we were doing soldierly yep. things. So I relate to what you say there.
Willem Dafoe speaking with Roger Ebert at the Cannes Film Festival. Let's hear a scene from Dafoe's 1986 Vietnam film, Platoon. Dafoe is talking with a young Marine played by Charlie Sheen. They're discussing Dafoe's rivalry with another sergeant.
Barnes has got it in for you, doesn't he?
Barnes believes in what he's doing.
And you? You believe?
65, yeah. Now. No. What happened today is just the beginning. We're gonna lose this war.
Come on. You really think so? Us?
We've been kicking other people's asses for so long, I figure it's time we got ours kicked.
We'll continue our conversation with Willem Dafoe and Roger Ebert in a moment. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an excerpt of a conversation between Willem Dafoe and film critic Roger Ebert, recorded at this year's Cannes Film Festival.
One of your favorite pictures of mine is Light Sleeper.
Good for you.
Which is
we're going to be great friends.
Yes,
you're talking about all the right stuff.
I knew I would be very comfortable talking to you.
Good, I'm glad
Paul Schrader
like that.
Picture. And I was talking to Schrader a couple of years ago. I see him from time to time, and as you probably know, because you know him much better than I do, he's a person who often announces, this will be my last film. I will never be hired again. This will be my last chance to work. I'm obsolete. Hollywood is moving away from what I do, and so forth. And most recently, he had codified this. Excuse me, the pubic hair comes in next week. When you get 4 hours of sleep, your voice is the first thing to go. He had codified this. He said, I am an existentialist who grew up in the 70s when we had existential films, and I am now trying to survive in an ironic age when every film has quotation marks around it. I think of you as, I think those are two categories that are very limiting, but if I had to choose one of them for you, it would be existential and not ironic. In other words, I think you are much more at home in characters who are absolutely who they seem to be than characters who are inviting the audience to wink.
I think that's true. I think that's very true. Yeah, I'm not a very ironic person. It's a shame because I find irony charming, but that's you're right on.
But you seem to be attracted to movies and to stories and to characters that who are really engaged with whatever terrific problems their life presents to them. Light Sleeper is an example of that.
I love moral crises. I love the heroism of people, even when they fail in these, when they have these crises. I think that's even the most depressing. What exhilarates me about movies is always when I find myself. Oh God, 4 hours of sleep.
Did you get four too?
Yeah.
I was at the Darren Aronofsky film until 2:30. Got to bed at 3. Got up at 7 to go to the 8:30 screening. This is kind of a, you know, when you get tired enough, you tell the truth. I think they demonstrated with Prisoners
that's
of War.
True. That's true. No, I know what I was going to say, but I was going to, you know, you get in the middle of this, of talking about something sometimes, and after you've been talking straight for 2 days, you get in the middle sometimes and you say, do I really want to complete this thought?
Yeah.
That's where I'm at, what I just did. So, forgive me, but...
Well, I don't really imagine that your favorite thing is doing publicity for movies.
It's not bad. It's not bad. I mean, I try to use it to see how I feel. And if the people aren't jerks, it can be fun. And I am an actor, you know, we do like attention. What happens sometimes is after a full day of doing this, you kind of get seduced into people thinking, I mean, well, you're an exception here, but people really thinking, you start to think people really want to know what you think. Mm-hmm. And they don't, because it's really, for the most part, for this kind of publicity that I'm usually doing, because it's really just a convention. It's a publicity arm. And what you do is you start to get loose, and then you start to talk, and you start to confess, and you start to really find the truth. And by the end of the day, sometimes you feel raped because you've kind of exposed yourself, and then realized that you weren't sure what it was for. And what made you expose yourself was you were seduced by this attention. And I think that's hard.
When I started out as a film critic and did interviews, I didn't have any clout. Nobody had heard of me. I was from Chicago, which, you know, and so forth and so on. Yet, when you did an interview, it would be like Lee Marvin would say, come out to the beach and we'll get drunk.
Uh-huh.
Or Robert Mitchum, you would be in the backseat of his car as he drove around Pittsburgh smoking pot and getting lost on his way to a location. That we were in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, bribing a snowplow operator to lead us back across the bridge to Pittsburgh. I mean, I'll never forget that day. Today, it's the 3-minute hotel room soundbite. Now, I know that actors are put on an assembly line in order to provide the greatest amount of publicity bang for the buck, and I understand that. But for the actor, it must be extremely odd to know that in a way it's just a take and then it's cut and the next person comes in. And it would almost be, it would seem to be freer if there were fewer rules. Do you sometimes feel as if the publicity machine limits your ability to be who you are or to feel like you are in the publicity situation like here at Cannes?
Sure, particularly with like television, with sound bites you feel. I don't think anecdotally. And I admire people that do. You know, sometimes I watch these trashy entertainment shows and a guy will get up there, you know, he'll be at an opening and he'll say something really quick, concise, and clever, you know? And I think, damn, I wish I could do that. You know, it's not particularly thoughtful, but it makes good entertainment. So I always feel conflicted when that's my job, to essentially do that, and I'm really ill-suited for it.
Do you find sometimes that when you're talking about your movies with people, they seem to feel that when you signed up for the project, you knew that the movie was going to be exactly the way it was.
Sure.
Why did you make this movie?
Sure.
Which your answer might be, I don't even know why the director made this movie, but the movie that I read the screenplay for, I know why I made that.
It's true.
I mean, they give you credit for having complete foresight of everything that's going to happen.
It's true. And when I approach a movie, I always try to be able to say there's one reason I absolutely know why I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it's intuitive. So even then, if the movie's a failure, I can live with myself. Because the tricky part is, I mean, what you're alluding to is, you know, you're in the mix, and even if you have a lot of power in the movie, so many things can go south. There's so many variations, and for an actor, and particularly, what you do is mediated by so many hands, for better and for worse, that it's always a little scary. I think the hardest thing to do, I'm you know, privately pleased when a critic like you says that I've made good choices. It's so hard, so difficult to make good choices.
Willem Dafoe speaking with film critic Roger Ebert. Their conversation was taped at the American Pavilion at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Dafoe's upcoming film, Shadow of the Vampire, will be released in December. Coming up, a review of a new recording by jazz musician Marty Ehrlich. This is Fresh Air. New York saxophonist, clarinetist, and flutist Marty Ehrlich has been a linchpin of groups led by many distinguished jazz composers, including Julius Hempel, John Carter, Mujal Richard Abrams, George Russell, and Anthony Braxton. Ehrlich has also led a variety of groups, including various trios and quintets, and a two-saxophone quartet called Traveler's Tales. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews their new CD.
Marty Ehrlich really knows how to blend with other saxophones. It's one reason he's turned up in so many big bands that don't get to rehearse very much. Leaders can count on him to help disparate reeds sound like a real section. It doesn't hurt that he's a resourceful improviser with a searing sound on alto saxophone either. Those talents serve him well in his quartet, Traveler's Tales. In the current edition, he's paired with tenor and soprano saxophonist Tony Malaby, one of the new stars of New York's downtown scene. He has that same bonding instinct his boss has. Playing a melody or improvising counterpoint, Ehrlich and Malaby are like the two tubes you use to make epoxy glue. The rhythm section on Marty Ehrlich's CD, Malinke's Dance, on the Omnitone label, is Bobby Previtt on drums and Jerome Harris on amplified acoustic bass guitar. In Harris's hands, that hybrid instrument can play the role of a bass fiddle or rock out like an electric bass. There are more than a few traces of rock and funk rhythms underpinning this music. Ehrlich wrote most of it, But there's also one tune by Julius Hemphill, and one borrowed from Bob Dylan and the band, Tears of Rage, with music by Richard Manuel. In the 60s, it was always a bit suspect when jazz musicians played rock songs. Back when rock threatened to put jazz out of business, it was hard to impute purely artistic motives to Count Basie recording Hang On Sloopy or Ella Fitzgerald singing These Boots Are Made for Walking. But since jazz has always looked to popular songs for material, and since most jazz musicians who've come up in the last 30 years were raised on rock, they had to confront it eventually. Lately, it's become almost commonplace, with singer Ann Dyer, pianist Jason Moran, and saxophonist Ken Vandermark covering the Beatles, Bjork, and Funkadelic on their respective new CDs. Tears of Rage was a good choice for Marty Ehrlich. It has a nice line and chords that move in a logical way. I wish he hadn't stuck quite so close to the melody all the time, but then jazz musicians under 50 don't have much experience yet playing the music of their life. It may take them a little while to get the hang of it, and of course, sometimes it won't work. But even if you hate the whole idea, you can probably count on these artists to stay true to the musical ideals that got them into jazz in the first place.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Malinka's Dance by Marty Ehrlich's Traveler's Tales. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Shorrock, and Phyllis Myers, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Joan Tui Westman produced today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, America's Drag Queen Sweetheart. We talk with RuPaul. He's appearing in the new film, But I'm a Cheerleader, this time without his 6-inch heels. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.